Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what might come down from the Supreme Court next week as we await their ruling on the Affordable Care Act. The Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, Elizabeth Wydra, joins us to discuss whether the radical anti-union ruling that came down last week could be a harbinger of the court's intentions to kill Obama's signature health care reform act. Then we'll examine how Mitt Romney lies with remarkable alacrity and frequency and how he gets away with it. Michael Cohen, a columnist for Foreign Policy and the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shape Modern America, joins us. We'll discuss his article in the UK Guardian, Mendacious Mitt, Romney's Bid to Become Liar-in-Chief. Then finally, Juan Cole joins us. He's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the author of Engaging the Muslim World. We'll discuss the results of the Egyptian presidential election, where it appears the ruling military council decided to allow the winner to win rather than face a violent backlash from the Muslim Brotherhood. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And we last spoke when you had been in the court, in the Supreme Court, witnessing the public hearings. And it's interesting that prior to the public hearings, I think 90% of all legal scholars and pundits in this country thought that there'd be no chance that the Supreme Court would mess with the Affordable Care Act at all under the Commerce Clause and in respect of precedent. Since then, the ground has clearly shifted. What did you make of the ruling that just went down on Thursday, this anti-union ruling where the in fact, there was a 72 ruling on the actual case itself about the unions infringing the free speech rights of their non-members. And then suddenly they turn around and come out with this radical 5-4 ruling written by Alito. That really does go after unions and their ability to participate in political action to the point where the four justices on the minority who were blindsided were just outraged that this had never been discussed, it had never been briefed, and that this was one of the most flagrant and aggressive acts of the conservative majority on this court.
Yeah, the ruling last week in Knox versus the Service Employees International Union that you're talking about is certainly not a good sign. It both harkens back to Citizens United and also could bode poorly for the ruling on the Affordable Care Act, which we expect this week. As you mentioned, so California, where the case comes from, has an agency shop arrangement in which public employees can choose by majority vote to be represented by a union. Of course, not every single individual may decide to be a member of that union, but the court has held that it's appropriate, and California law says it's appropriate, to charge a sort of a fair share fee for even these public sector non-union members to cover their fair share of collective bargaining activities that the union does on everyone's behalf. And so what is remarkable about the decision last Thursday in the Supreme Court case is that the court has, in at least six cases over the years, upheld the union's ability to do this, to charge non-members their fair share of collective bargaining and related political activity costs if they get the opportunity to opt out at some point. And so this case had to do with a special assessment that came up after then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger tried to put through some very anti-union laws. You know, this is sort of sweeping the nation. We saw obviously all the great turmoil in Wisconsin with Governor Scott Walker trying to limit unions' abilities to represent their workers in that state. And the court really flipped precedent on its head by saying, you know what, not only do we require that people be able to opt out of these assessments, but you unions need to get an affirmative opt-in from public employees who are not members of the union for these special assessments. And as you mentioned, the four justices who are the more liberal justices just took the majority to task for this, not only because of the substance of that decision, but because it was an issue that wasn't briefed or argued by the parties. So again, just as we saw in Citizens United, the court reached out to get to an extremely important constitutional issue on its own that was neither briefed nor argued by the parties nor raised by them. And unlike Citizens United, didn't even have the courtesy to ask for re-argument and rebriefing on it. And the minority liberal justices said, hey, you know, the conservatives shouldn't be reaching out in this judicially activist way. That goes against what we are supposed to do as courts, which is to be very careful in striking down laws as unconstitutional, especially when the parties haven't raised those constitutional arguments on their own.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. And I would actually take issue with you, Elizabeth, on a minor point, and that is that you refer to the four justices in the minority as liberals. There really aren't any liberals, to my mind, on this court. There are a lot of
more liberal justices.
Well, no, but I mean, in the historical context, you know, there are some arch and ultra conservatives, and there are a number of corporatists, some centrists, a lot of Catholics, as a matter of fact, but I don't believe there are any liberals in the tradition of Thurgood Marshall and William O. Douglas, who, by the way, President Ford replaced with the conservative justice, John Paul Stevens. And ironically, John Paul Stevens has ended up as one of the most liberal on the court. And he has recently, in his retirement, has broken precedent to castigate his former fellow justices over Citizens United. So maybe that just shows you how much the country's and the court has moved to the right.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that we are even discussing right now whether or not the central portions of the Affordable Care Act could be struck down this week is a sign of just how far to the right the court has gone. And the people from across the ideological spectrum, for example, Charles Freed, who was President Reagan's Solicitor General, his main attorney before the Supreme Court, everyone agreed that, look, whether you think it's a good law or a bad law, this is squarely constitutional under Congress's expressly delegated constitutional power to regulate interstate commerce or to tax and spend for the general welfare, or certainly to pass laws that are, as the Constitution says, necessary and proper to executing those powers. So the fact that we might, and frankly, I think it's too close to call after argument which way the court is going to go. And the fact that it's too close to call instead of being unanimous or maybe 7-2 or 6-3 in favor of the act is, as you said, a real sign of the shift to the right that the court has taken over the years.
Well, but this sort of aggressive and brazen act on the part of the court in this anti-union, on the Roberts Court in this anti-union ruling that came down on Thursday, it seems to me that it raises the very notion of judicial activism, which is normally what the right accuses the left of. But in this
exactly.
case, it's pretty clear that that this is a very judicially activist court. And my fear is that they could put our first black president in his place. And if you look, judge by the recent display of conservative contempt, that when the president was interrupted in the Rose Garden by a right-wing so-called journalist, the disrespect out there is quite palpable. And we are in a political culture of win at all costs and whatever it costs to win. And it's worth noting that the a recent CBS New York Times poll, 76% of Americans think that the Supreme Court justices are more informed by political partisanship than judicial reasoning. So I see this ruling that took place, this anti-union ruling, as completely in step with what's going on in Wisconsin and what's going on with the broader Republican agenda. And it's as if Alito is just working with Romney and Alec, and you know, it all feels like it's coordinated. And this is not what this is, this makes a mockery of the separation of powers.
Well, it certainly is depressing to read the anti-union ruling that completely disregards precedent and goes out of its way to read the Constitution in a way that is not required either by its text and history or by the Supreme Court's interpretation of it. And that is why it's concerning as we go into this last week of the Supreme Court's term with the not only the opinion coming down in the Affordable Care Act case, but also in the challenge that the federal government has brought against Arizona's anti-immigrant SB 1070 law, that if we have a court, or at least a conservative majority on that court, that is willing to disregard the Constitution's text and history and longstanding court precedent, in some cases going back to the very early years of our nation, if we have a conservative majority willing to do that, that is very distressing, and frankly, for me, depressing. And it's not only disrespectful to the president in the same way that, you know, that Rose Garden incident was, but it's a slap in the face to the American people, to the Supreme Court as an institution, and to the basic fundamental values of the United States, which is that all people are equal under the law and that our Constitution is our touchstone along this progressive arc of history that our nation has journeyed upon. And so it is very difficult when you can't even have faith that the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, will rule according to a document that has served us well and has been amended by we the people to make it even better over the last more than 200 years.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wider, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Now, your organization, your think tank, have released a report that indicates that the Roberts Court is pretty much in lockstep with the Chamber of Commerce. So can you elaborate on the findings in this report?
Yes, so we have been doing work on, which you can find at our website, theusconstitution.org, looking at the success of the Chamber of Commerce and the Supreme Court, which is generally accepted as sort of the voice of corporate America in the courts. And in the Roberts Court, the chamber has been more successful than even past courts that had, you know, quite a number of conservative justices on them, the Warren Court and the Berger Courts. And in the Roberts Court, this term in particular, the chamber has prevailed in every case it filed a brief in. And, you know, there are two more rulings, I think, waiting. But we could be looking at a term where the Supreme, where the Chamber of Commerce is getting a perfect record of wins before the High Court. And that is remarkable. I can't, you know, you talk a lot of times, people say that, although probably not this year, that the courts are very pro-government, that the government often wins in the court, especially in criminal cases. But now you're getting to a point where the chamber always wins, and that is really a remarkable outcome, and we will certainly be looking next week to see if, in fact, the Chamber of Commerce does get its perfect record this term. But even if it doesn't, it has had a remarkably high success rate, more so than it has even in, you know, a lot of people say, oh, look, it's not anything remarkable about the Roberts Court. But our studies comparing the Roberts Court with past Supreme Court, the makeup of the Supreme Court under other chief justices hasn't shown that to be true.
Well, as I say, I don't see this court as being, I see that a lot of these conservatives as being corporatists as well, particularly Roberts and Alito. Of course, we have, we could have a corporatist as the president, and if it's effectively Mitt Romney would be the CEO of USA Inc. So we have, I think, a corporatist court. We may have a corporatist presidency as well. It's amazing to me that none of the in neither Roberts or Alito's confirmation did anybody ask about their corporatism. They're both corporate lawyers, aren't they? They've done a lot of work for corporate.
We're in private practice.
Yes, and there are a lot of corporate lawyers out in America, surely, in terms of the legal profession.
There are, and you know, I would just say that I don't think that simply having been in private practice means that one is always going to rule, based on corporate America's interests as opposed to what the law requires. I mean, look, if Chief Justice Roberts had been true to his statement that he was just going to be sort of the umpire of justice calling balls and strikes as he saw them, according to the Constitution's text and history, then we would not have Citizens United, we would not have the anti-union ruling last week, and we'd have a ruling next week upholding the Affordable Care Act and the minimum coverage provision. So my problem isn't necessarily with his past career. I was in private practice myself, and I like to think that, I could certainly think fairly about the issues that would come before me, but it is, when you look at the numbers and not just sort of the sense that you get from the court, you know, the chamber's overall win-loss rate before the Roberts Court is up to 68%, which is higher than during the Rehnquist Court, which was a general 56%, and dramatically higher than its success rate before the Berger Court, when the chamber only won 43% of its cases. So they're doing much better before the Roberts Court than they have previously.
Well, it's still an extraordinary, it's so hard for me not to see a lot of these rulings, man. You go back to Bush v. Gore as being coordinated with Republican politics and a part of the general Republican political plan and strategy, if you will, and for example, just in closing, the whole centerpiece of this argument has been about the individual mandate, and it's become highly propagandized. The conservative women of America they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars, both them and other groups, to demonize this so-called individual mandate. And guess what? It's only 7% of the Affordable Care Act. Only 7% of the American people are subject to that mandate. And it's not even a mandate. There are no penalties and no fines. It's only the worst they can do is not give you your tax refund. So it seems to me that, I don't know who's failing here, whether the White House can't step out and point out the obvious overblown nature of this argument or why nobody in the could have told the Supreme Court how overblown it is. But the Supreme Court jumped on it and ran with it, at least the conservatives did, as though they were, part of some Republican super PAC or propaganda campaign.
But it was disheartening at the argument to hear Justice Scalia essentially sound like someone who should be on the primetime block on Fox News Channel, even repeating this sort of ridiculous broccoli argument that if you can require people to maintain a minimum level of insurance or pay a tax penalty if you don't, that's equivalent to saying that the government can be able to force people to eat broccoli. Now, any serious constitutional lawyer or person with a lot of common sense knows that broccoli argument plays well on TV, but is absolute nonsense when it comes to constitutional law. So it really was disappointing to hear Justice Scalia tear up those sort of Tea Party talking points in court. But, you know, I hold on to hope that the other justices have read closely the briefs filed in the case, including a brief that I filed on behalf of state legislators, more than 500 state legislators from every state in the Union, D.C., and Puerto Rico, who argue for upholding the act, noting that the American people greatly need it in order to have access to quality, affordable health care, and that the Constitution absolutely empowers the federal government to provide national solutions to national problems.
Well, Elizabeth Wydra, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation, has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the liar in chief.